This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. We are back after 4 weeks. I am joined this week by, you know, two fantastic human beings who I love to talk about comic books with, Brian Murray.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
Thank you both for joining me this week. Super excited that we're back. But before we start the show, I do want to remind everyone out there, we are still in the middle of doing our fun Midsummer's Night's Dream survey or something. I don't know. It's a 2017 I Read Comic Books survey. If you want to take it, you could potentially win $10 to Comixology in a cool little e-gift card that I will send directly to you. So go fill out that survey because you listen to this show and you love it. But let's actually get on to what we're here to talk about, which is comic books. So let me ask the question I ask every single week. How have you been? How have comic books been? Nick White.
I've been good. Things have been busy, and there's been a lot of reading going on, despite the fact that the show hasn't been active. There's still been a lot to read. There's still a lot going on this summer. Everything from Aliens Dead Orbit to Valiant's Secret Weapons. There's a ton of stuff to read right now. I can go into some of that right now, or do you want me to just...
Whatever you want to talk about, man.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, okay. It's how have you been? How have comic books been? You're telling me that you don't read comics just for this show? Like,
right,
you actually
right.
kept reading comics for 4 weeks?
Yeah, it's just as a compulsion. I guess it's something I must like or something.
Maybe.
So I've gotten around to reading a couple things here and there, but we'll talk about some of the more recent things. That way it's nothing too dated. I did finally read Reborn number 6. I know that this was one that Mike was not eagerly anticipating. And for some of you, especially those of you on a budget, you definitely had this sort of issue blocked out as, I guess I won't be eating for the next week. Issue 6 is the final issue. It was delayed by, I think, a month or two, and it's $6. I can't really, without giving too much away, I can't really say I thoroughly enjoyed it. It feels like Mark Miller attempted to have his cake and eat it too. And by that, I mean he felt like he needed to put some sort of an end note on the series, but also needed to leave the door open for any sort of potential in the future to revisit it. Which, honestly, the guy should have realized, like, what's the likelihood that Greg Capullo's schedule is going to be free again anytime soon? It's not good, okay? It's not good. I think DC occasionally, puts him in, ankle chains and sits him down at the table and forces him to draw. So,
yeah.
Honestly, the likelihood was not good. He should have gone for a much stronger, definitive, conclusive ending, and he didn't. Instead, this feels like the end of an opening arc of a book, not the end of a miniseries. So,
right.
Was not a huge fan of that. If anything else, you know what just bugs me? I don't like people wasting Greg Capullo's time, okay? We're talking
about... 'cause he could be drawing Batman.
Yeah, we're talking about a man who has a finite amount of energy and a finite amount of time, and we have to carefully choose how he uses it. He needs to carefully choose how he uses it. And I'm sure Mark Miller pays the big bucks, but honestly, it just felt like a waste. I read Kamandi Challenge number 5. You're probably saying, Nick, I think Kamandi Challenge 7 comes out this week or came out last week. You're right. I'm behind. But Bill Willingham's issue was probably actually the best issue of the series so far, and I honestly did not think that was going to be the case. But then again, coming from the guy who did Fables, he of course is very accustomed to anthropomorphized animals and just general fantasy / fantastical elements. So maybe he had, a feather in his cap when it came to that one. Plus, kudos to him, because based on the ending of this book, like, I think there must have been, like, a communication error, and nobody said, like, okay, when you're done with the issue, this is going to get passed off to another writer, so, just be aware of that. I don't think he got the memo. In fact, I think the memo he got was, you're writing the last issue, because boy, oh boy, did he leave this book in a place that I don't think anyone is going to be able to take over and actually... let's just say some miracles are going to have to be, like, committed. Like, the sort of miracle that the Catholic Church has to step in and, like, independently investigate and, like, verify on two different occasions. Like, that kind of miracle is going to need to happen to get this book anywhere back into the realm of, like, human existence where something could happen. Very interested right. with that.
So do you think that you read the end of the first quote-unquote arc within the 12-issue miniseries? Like, are they trying to do one continuous story? Or yeah, do you think it exactly. might be broken up into, like, arc, single issue, arc, final issue?
Right, I know what you're saying. I don't see this as arcs. It is just sort of, it's a maxi series. I see this as a 12-issue maxi series, and the whole point of this game, or whatever you want to call it, is that at the end of every issue, it gets passed off onto a different team, and that team, hence the name the Kamandi Challenge, is faced with the challenge of actually getting the book up and running again, and right. then also the challenge of leaving the book in a seemingly impossible place for the next team. Although, like I said, Bill Willingham apparently didn't get the memo and said, "All right, so we're ending the book at issue five. Here you go. You're welcome." Very interesting, great experiment, great effort, and sort of exercise to get a whole bunch of creative people. Even a lot that don't normally work with DC, or even several that largely work with Marvel, to really pay tribute to Jack Kirby for his 100th birthday.
Right.
So I read that. I read Grass Kings number 4. If you want to talk about leaving books in impossible situations, I got to hand it to Matt Kint. Like, issues 1 and 2 were a slow burn, but 3 and 4, like, this book is on a crash course trajectory right now. Like, things just keep escalating and escalating. And in the next issue, apparently, like, the whole, like, neighboring police force from the town over is coming in to, like, smash up their little utopia of sorts. Tyler Jenkins' art never disappoints. Really enjoying that book. For those who aren't reading it, I think we've got to be, like, pretty close to trade at this point. So that's a thing too.
That has me excited, because that's when I'm going to start reading this book.
Yeah. it's good. It's really, really good. And if you're a fan of watercolors, there's another reason to read it. One other two quick things. Old Guard number 5, possibly Greg Rucka's best book out right now, and Leandro Fernandez is on art, and it just keeps having these fun little exercises about how do you deal with a team of mercenaries that are seemingly immortal, and yet maybe not totally immortal, and 5 was a real fun issue because it deals with the question of how do you cope with when you're betrayed by another person who's also immortal? Like, how do you deal with this person, and how do you, like, deal with the fact that you can't ever completely put them out of the picture, so to speak? Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about Dead Orbit later, but the other book I do want to briefly bring up is I read Dark Days to Forge. Yes, you're probably thinking, Nick, Dark Days, the casting is out. Like, you're really behind. And that's true. And why didn't you read this book, Nick? Well, for some people, the art trio of John Romita Jr., Andy Kubert, I think it's Andy, I don't think it's Adam, I should have looked this up, and Jim Lee, normally that trio of names for some people can really attract them to a book. For me, that's somehow against all odds, putting three artists on a book that one of them by themselves is kind of a bit of a deterrent for me. But at Nick, least I think... Go ahead, Mike.
Before you get too super deep into your Q&A with yourself, yeah. You explain what exactly Dark Days of the Forge is? Because I feel like I have no idea, and I'm
usually
on the pulse with this stuff.
No, you're absolutely right. I guess it's the title isn't that obvious. So Dark Days of Forge is an oversized one-shot that I guess if you wanted to just casually call it something, you could call it a Batman book, I guess. But really, if you've heard anything about DC's event called Metal, which is going to be taking place largely in August... Mm-hmm. This is considered one of the sort of lead-in books to it, which is then followed by Dark Days, the casting. And I wouldn't say it's, like, definitively a Batman work. There are Green Lantern elements to it. There are Hawkman, Hawkgirl, elements to it. If anything else, read this issue because Mr. Terrific shows up and he's a lot of fun, and Mr. Miracle shows up. And both of those guys are great. So
okay,
the art is kind of iffy, but the event has a real 2009-2010 Geoff Johns summer blockbuster event. Rope in everything, stakes are high, characters are interacting with other characters that you never thought they would, things are like cranked up to 11 and it's insane. And if you remember any of those sorts of events, it's got that real sense of adventure and fun, and anything is going to possibly happen going on. So those are just a few things I've been reading.
Cool. I don't even know where to start with this Dark Days thing, because it's a summer event, and I'm immediately just biased to not like it, so we'll see. Maybe this will be like that one that Geoff Johns wrote that I really liked that I can never remember the name of. That was actually pretty cool, where, you know, all the CSA come over and destroy the whole world.
You're talking about, was that Evil with, no, not Evil Within.
Forever Evil.
Forever Evil,
that's
yeah.
That's the one. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see.
Exactly.
Maybe one day I'll catch up on the big quote-unquote metal saga.
Well, it's very weird, you know, because Scott Snyder is like, you can read all of the metal by itself and just read the event books and it's self-contained. But then, oh, by the way, we're rolling out 6 one-shots that are going to each follow a different character. And then we're also going to have one of those fun sort of sub undercurrent mini arcs that's going to bounce through like 7 different books that you probably don't normally read.
Gotcha. Because you got to rope everything in.
So we're hearing different things.
That makes my heart hurt just hearing you say that.
Yeah.
Speaking of hearts hurting, Brian, what have you been reading lately?
Oh boy.
I don't know why I assumed that. Speaking of but
like the man just got married and that's what you're going to say? Like that's the segue?
I will say that 17-year-old Brian was thrilled at the sight of my my list this week.
Mm-hmm.
I read Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe Again, number 1.
Oh good.
Who's writing that?
Bunn.
Okay. Colin Bunn. Okay.
Yeah. Talk about a book that nobody asked for and nobody needs. like, Bunn does a fine job with what is ultimately a played-out premise.
Right.
Are you familiar with the original Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe?
Not enough to understand how it could warrant a sequel, I guess.
It's not a
sequel.
Isn't
it really not that much of a difference from just Deadpool in general?
Yeah, there's some kind of secret code phrase that brainwashes Deadpool and makes him think that he's in a cartoon world and then kill all his friends.
Christ. Jesus.
Okay.
It's, yep. I'm not going to pick up number 2, is I guess where that story ends.
Gotcha.
Maybe there needs to be a very just boring Deadpool book where he just does office work and you just sit there and observe all of it, and there's like no point where the fourth wall gets broken or things get zany, and that just eventually fucks with all the people that think that the whole joke is that eventually it's going to turn into that, but it never does. So instead you like watch like Deadpool, you know, file his taxes. And it
ends with him getting a promotion to middle management, but turning it down because he doesn't want the additional responsibility.
Deadpool attempting to carefully pick out an energy-efficient automobile, but he can't make up his mind and has to go online to research it more. Like, you just sit through things like this. This sounds great, because there will be those people that will sit through 50 issues going, I know it. I know it's going to happen. At some point, this is going to be the big joke. This is going to be the joke. And then it jump cuts to them and, like, their tombstone, and then underneath it says in quotes, this is going to be the big one, I swear, end quote.
But
where your life becomes the zany Deadpool world because the comic book is so plain.
Your life is forfeit to the Deadpool joke, yeah.
Mike, I know that you would not like this book because it opens, the book opens on Dead Gambit.
Oh, good.
And then Deadpool brutally murders Rogue in the first issue.
Oh, good.
So your OTP gets the axe in
is there a term for like time. The antithesis of one's fan fiction? Because this sounds like the like reverse of Mike fan fiction. Like it's the complete, like if you took that and you inversed it completely, this is yeah.
I don't know one, but I challenge you, the listeners out there, to find us a definite or find us a word or a phrase that could sum up what the antithesis of fan fiction is.
I'd say like it's anti fan fiction, but now it sounds like Antifa fiction, which is
faux fiction.
Ooh, that's not bad. But we need like fan that. In there and anti faux fiction.
We'll figure it out, listeners. Fan-ti-fiction? I challenge you,
Mike. Can we add this to the survey? I also read the first three issues of Edge of Venomverse, which is an attempt to reclaim the fun and glory of Spider-Verse.
Mm-hmm. I've heard good things about this.
There are good things about it. There's stuff that I liked. The first issue is actually really cool because it focuses all on X-23. It's a universe where X-23 has the Venom symbiote and is like using it to murder gangsters who are threatening children. Like,
okay,
it's pretty cool. I'm wrong on this, guys, but Venom seems like that character from just being a casual outside observer that like Marvel fans clamor for, and then they do something with him and everyone's like, no, that's not what we meant. No, that's not it. No, ugh. There is a perfect Venom book out there waiting for us, I swear, but ugh, God, this is not it.
You gotta understand that in this case, we went from the high of X-23 Venom to the devastating low of Gwenpool Venom.
Oh. All right.
Yeah, Nick, that's how I feel too.
That sounds like a mashup that's unnecessary. Really? Because it's like Spider-Gwen and Deadpool and Venom? Like,
oh no.
I don't know.
No, Mike. Gwenpool has nothing to do with Spider-Gwen, except for latching on to the popularity of having a character with Gwen in their name.
Yeah.
Oh.
Her name is Gwendolyn Poole. She's an OC, do not steal.
Oh.
Complete with like pink dyed ends of her hair and everything.
Okay.
Jesus.
And it kind of sucks because like the Venom symbiote is a really interesting character in that issue. Gwen isn't so much. But
God.
They do a lot of explaining her backstory in the book too. And I just like if you like Gwenpool, more power to you. I'm not trying to tell anybody they shouldn't like what they like, but I don't care.
Maybe you forgot what this podcast is about, Brian. Jesus. I feel like a month off and you've got all these ideas that I'm not okay with.
I've gone soft.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then issue three, it's Ghost Rider Venom.
Sure.
Which, oh, I again, heard about that.
Cool concept, but they turned him into like super edgy, fucking like, I'm gonna eat your sin and my car is gonna eat your flesh. And
oh, so they're bringing back 90s Ghost Rider is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's I don't know, they spent a lot of time like philosophizing about how like the alien parasite and the hell parasite have teamed up and Robbie Reyes is just along for the ride,
right?
And it's like, oh, cool.
Taking it from both barrels.
Yeah.
Two symbiote, two furious. When you thought one was enough.
I'm going to finish it out because it's a five-issue mini. And
yeah,
okay.
There are so many cool things you could do with this premise that I'm not ready to write it off. But the last two issues left me a little cold.
Okay.
Well, Jordan says if you want a good Venom book, you gotta read Venom Space Knight. That's what he tells me all the time. So
yeah, I've heard the same.
People out there looking for a good Venom book, it's a bit different, but it's got Ariel Olivetti on art, so I don't need to make any argument for that book beyond that point. You should be buying it right now. Like, end of story.
Well, the book that I wanted to talk about before I realized what kind of feelings I had about these other ones was Predator Hunters. I read issues 2 and 3 of that, and it's Chris Warner writing Francisco Ruiz Velasco on art. It's really nice to see the humans actually like ready for once. Yeah. So it's
That's what's pissing me off about that book, Brian, is they're actually getting, they're allowing you the chance. I just read number two a few days ago. They're allowing you the chance to get to know these characters. And I'm like, no, no, no. You can't make these relatable people to me. You can't do this to me before you kill them. I need to feel nothing about these people.
Well, spoiler alert.
No!
You're exactly right. I mean, they don't all die. They do better than people usually do against the Predator.
What is the mortality rate against the Predator?
I think
like 96.
I think that he killed 3 of them before they took him down.
Mm-hmm.
And then they find out that there's 3 more Predators on the island. And the issue ends with pants shitting terror in the woods. Which is what you Fantastic. Want from a Predator yeah. book, I mean.
Yes, yes.
The art for this book is great, and the colors for that book are fantastic. Very, very bright, very sort of even kind of pastel-y and neon at times for something that could obviously be browns and grays.
Yeah, and I'm really glad they made the choice they did, because I get enough browns and grays from Dead Orbit.
Yeah.
That's not a dig on that book, but it is true.
Yeah, yeah.
What about you, Mike?
Yeah, for me, I've read a ton of stuff. I mean, 4 weeks off does not mean I stop trying to keep up with my weekly books. I read Punisher number 14, Becky Cloonan, Matt Horak. This book continues to be exactly what I want in a Punisher book, especially after they finished the first real ongoing, quote-unquote, ongoing story that the Punisher had in the first 8 or 10 issues. Now they've just been doing short little one-shot stories of Punisher just seeing some bad guys and just fucking killing them. He's like, you are a bad guy. It is time to die. You have done something bad. Now you are dead. Back and forth. And it's exactly what you want out of a Punisher story. Like, he is that character that you get to feel true catharsis with. He is actually doing he's cleaning up the streets. You know, he's not allowing for any ambiguity about like what is bad and what is right. Like, sure, you may be a petty thief. He's gonna break your hand, but if you have, you know, beaten someone to near death, you're gonna just die. It's been constant, short and sweet justice, and I really appreciate that with this book. And Matt Horak's art has been top notch. 14 was a spectacular one shot story. If you want to get a sampling of what Becky Cloonan is doing with this book, I highly recommend you pick up number 14. You need to know nothing other than the Punisher is a dude who kills people for doing bad things. And that's it. It's superb. I also read The Immortal Iron Fists number 1, and that's plural, Immortal Iron Fists. This is the Comixology Unlimited original book, or the Comixology original book, I think is what it's called. So digital only. This is written by Cary Kyle Andrews with art by Afu Chan. I don't know why I pronounced it like that. But this is a sequel series to the Iron Fist Deadly Weapons story that Cary Kyle Andrews did with... he did like the whole book. He did letters, inks, coloring, everything for Marvel a while back. It was a maxi series. And so he introduced in that book a character called Pei. And she is, spoilers kind of, she is the new Iron Fist, but Danny Rand is still alive. So Danny Rand has to trade her to be the new Iron Fist. So we get a little bit of introspective about who this character is. We get more into her head, since it mostly takes place from her point of view. And I really never thought a book could make me love the Iron Fist world more, but Pei is such a fantastic character. This really feels like an all-ages book. You don't really need to know much about the previous run of Iron Fist to understand where this book is coming from, because they give you a really solid introduction to the character, introduction to the world, why these people are in the places that they are. It's a really solid jumping on point. I was totally, totally, totally impressed with this book. Just because it came out of left field. They announced it at SDCC. I downloaded it the day that they announced it, read it on the train home, and I was blown away. I am definitely waiting for more, and I'm super glad that I get it with my Comixology Unlimited subscription for free. So super pumped for the next issue of this book. And I highly recommend you guys pick this up if you can.
I gotta say, I'm really, really impressed with the, that book is a major get in terms of Comixology Unlimited. Getting an exclusive that's not only a big two, but a big two that also manages to have some pretty top tier talent on it. So that's pretty impressive.
Iron Fist is really in the cultural view right now too, with the TV show and Defenders.
Yeah, coming timing out wise, jeez.
Yeah. It's perfect timing. So if you have a CU subscription, get in.
I will say, can two people have the Iron Fist? Is that a thing, or is it one thing that's passed on? How does what are the glowing fist rules of lending and borrowing, Michael? what are the terms and conditions of having a glowing fist?
Mike, so break down the entire Iron Fist mythos for us right now.
Brian, we're fine. It's not X-Men. This should only take 1 minute.
Yeah. So this is actually a pretty simple answer I can give you. Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction, during their big run on the Immortal Iron Fist, they did basically define that multiple Iron Fists can exist at the same time. But okay. From my understanding, only one can be in Kunlun, which is the outer world extra dimension where the Iron Fist people live. And so multiple people can carry the mantle at the same time, but the more of them that are alive, the less, like, the power is basically distributed equally between them.
Oh.
So there isn't, like, this big power surge race thing, because I believe when they fight each other, it, like, cancels out the power or something like that. But ultimately, there can be multiple Iron Fists, but the newer Iron Fist typically has a little bit more power, and the older one is supposed to basically is basically told, either give up the mantle or just die already. But in the story... If I'm remembering this correctly, multiple people with the Iron Fist power were alive. But there is also this ongoing story arc of, technically, you can only live to be like 32 years old, and then something will kill you. Like, fate will find a way for you to die. So there's a bigger thing, and I highly recommend you go read Immortal Iron Fist by Matt Fraction, David Aja, Ed Brubaker, and then the subsequent series that are basically the continuation of that story by Dwayne Straczynski. Really, really top-notch Iron Fist, and I'm pretty sure that's setting the playing field for what is the current Iron Fist mythos. So really, really good stuff, and it'll give you some more background on the Iron Fist world, but by no means do you have to read that in order to read Immortal Iron Fists, the new series that came out. Otherwise, okay. I did read Aliens Dead Orbit 1 through 3, and all I can say is, holy fucking shit, this book is good. Like,
yeah.
Like wow. Wow, I'm
aboard,
so
butthead.
So impressed. This, like, James Stokoe's everything in this book puts me right into this, like, it's so massive. There's no words. I have no words other than wow. This book is top notch. If you want to read a balls to the wall alien story, this is it. That's it. I did read Descender Volume 4. My notes for this are sad times all time about robots, ? Because that's what this volume was. And the constant phrase of driller a killer, driller a real killer is still my favorite thing in this whole book. I don't want to go too deep into this, but Descender is a surprise book that I'm glad that I got on board to start reading, because I very much anxiously wait for every trade at this point. Because I'm reading it in that format. And finally, I did read Astonishing X-Men number 1. I don't know what is fucking going on in this book. There was so much crammed into the pages of this $5 comic that it really needed to be double the length, and it really needed a little more explanation. Because
Michael, which one is Astonishing again? Please remind us.
So Astonishing X-Men is the new series by Charles Soule and Jim Cheung. The art is beautiful. Jim Cheung's faces and everyone always looks the same, so it's fine. But ultimately, so much shit was happening, and they introduced a character that I kind of expected from page 2. Which is fine. Like, I should say the villain from page 2, I figured that out. But, like, that's as someone who's read a lot of comic books with the X-Men in it. I kind of saw it coming. Nonetheless, unlike
all of
the... X-Men
have, like, 4 villains, so...
yeah. It's like 400. But I won't get into that. The thing that really irked me about this book is, sure, I've got a lot of, like, X-Men history in my head. So jumping into this book, I knew everyone was, I knew all the background, I knew all the weird complex context that they were trying to imply with a couple of people. The thing that irked me was that all of the other jumping on points for number ones have done a fantastic job of getting you up to speed and saying, hey, read this book. X-Men Gold, fantastic jumping on point. X-Men Blue, pretty good jumping on point. Weapon X, hey, remember Wolverine? Okay, jumping on point. Like in the, it goes down from there. Jean Grey is probably at the same tier as X-Men Blue, and Iceman is probably up there with X-Men Gold. I think you could read Iceman and you could read X-Men Gold without any context of the X-Men and get a pretty good understanding about what's going on. All the other ones, like Astonishing X-Men by far is the worst one for jumping on. I would not recommend this to a new X-Men fan by a long shot. So I really hope Soul knows what the fuck he's doing with this book, because this number one felt overpacked, and number two looks like it's going to be even deeper with crazy weird context. So if Marvel's whole resurrection thing was, hey, come on back to the X-Men, they fucked up with this book. I will straight up say that. I loved it to death as a very deep X-Men person, but anyone else I would not recommend this to. So Astonishing X-Men, whew, oh boy. And they didn't even have the special variant cover for this book, and I'm still peeved about
see,
this.
See, here's the crux of the argument. I just want to get that off my chest. Here we go. Yeah. I would say devil's advocate to this and devil's advocate to every comic book publisher out there who their number one favorite phrase is new jumping on point, best jumping on point, which first off I have a problem with because obviously the phrase gets thrown around to a point that it means nothing. But beyond that, and maybe this is a slightly unpopular opinion, but maybe not every single book needs to be the most accessible, like the scenario you're describing. Like, I don't see a problem with what, one out of seven maybe being a bit more steeped in lore,
sure,
or you know, sure, throws you up to your, you know you're up to your neck in it, you know, right off the bat. Because I do think there is sort of, and of course that turns into a whole treatise, but like I think there is sort of a bit of an issue with attempting to take every single book and, you know, engineer it for this accessibility, because like I said just like what, 1 minute ago, 90% of the time they're flat out lying about it being that accessible or the fact that they've engineered it for that purpose. So I don't see a huge problem with what, like a one out of seven being this way. Although, are you saying that outside of that accessibility issues, you're having other problems with it, or that?
Yeah, so I like this book for a couple of reasons that I won't really go into because it's full spoilers, so I don't want to be spoiler because this book is fairly recent.
Sure.
But there were things that I liked about it, but ultimately, this book, by the time it was done, I was like, that's the hook. Like, the hook felt, in for like the next issue, the sudden thing that happens at the end, you know, felt so forced because sure, they spent like 30-ish or like 25 pages out of the 28 or whatever it was building up like the team coming together, and it was the most bizarre thing in the entire world that made very little sense within the context of some of the characters. I mean, like, yeah, you need a reason for, you know, a call to action to bring everyone together, but I think that there could have been a couple better executed ways to do that. And nonetheless, this book feels crammed with characters because I'm pretty sure there's like 9 people on this team, and I don't know how Soul is going to manage the work or like the load of this book in the 22 to 24 page issue like size. So I'm really hoping that he does something like he splits the teams up somehow, and he kind of did.
Half but like, of them are going to die next issue.
Yeah. Well,
pay attention to which ones aren't interacting well with the group or don't seem to have the ability to.
Well, they're not going to kill. They're not going to kill Old Man Logan. So what are we going to do? I don't know. I think this book is off to a rough start. I mean, Soul is not a bad writer, so I'm not trying to like say anything that he won't be able to handle it. I'm just concerned because this book felt really clunky to start, and that's not a good sign for a number one, especially with a top tier title like this and with a big franchise. It's just worrisome. And it, you know, like out of the 12 X-Men books that have come out, we're gonna lose at least 4 or 5. So I'm worried that like we've got this huge big bang team that's on this book, and then it's gonna get cut after like 4 issues. So we'll see. that's all. But I don't want to go any further on this. We've already spent way too much time talking about this one X-Men book. Welcome back. It's been 4 weeks. Back to X-Men. Let's move on.
We've had a lot of feelings build up in these 4 weeks.
Yeah. I promised salt on Twitter. I did promise salt this week. But that's because of the thing I'm going to talk about in a second. Our comic picks for this week. Comics are out on August 2nd, 2017. Let's see what everyone's excited for or not excited for. Let's start with Brian.
Well, I'm looking forward to Darth Vader number 4. And not exclusively because I'm a giant Star Wars fanboy who buys everything Star Wars that comes out. That's probably why I picked up issue number 1. But it's been fun to watch. This is Charles Soule writing and Giuseppe Camuncoli on art. But it's fun to see, like, young, pissed off Darth Vader. Because by the time we get to him in the movies and to the comics that followed the original trilogy, he's kind of like cooled off into this, you know, monolithic murder force that everybody quakes in fear of. But mm-hmm. in this new Darth Vader series, he shows up. People are like, who the fuck is that? Oh, God, my face.
Are you saying this is a Darth Vader that like would have listened to The Used? Is that like the Darth Vader phase we're dealing with right now?
I don't think I'd sully his legacy like that.
Sure,
but certainly some kind of
maybe
angsty,
AFI, Brian.
Yeah, we'll go with that. Just because that's what I listened to during my pissed off youth. So, but yeah, I mean it's a side of Darth Vader where you can still see Anakin Skywalker.
I think
that that's a really interesting take on the character, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Let's quickly put you in a corner here, Brian. This is only issue 4, but and so you've only read 3 issues in this series, but do you feel like you like this more than the previous iteration of Darth Vader? Do you like it less, or do you want to take the apples and oranges out and just say that they're fundamentally different things?
I like this Darth Vader more, I think. I mean, there are moments in the other Darth Vader series I liked better. All I'm surrounded by is fear and dead men springs to mind. The most mm-hmm. badass scene in comics history. but I mean, that series also gave us Dr. Aphra. And like, I can't put this above that because I fucking love Dr. Aphra.
Gotcha.
That's fair. Yeah. Let me know when they reach the thing that they were hyping this book for, which was the origins of Darth Vader's lightsaber. Like, I literally remember that line from the solicits, and I went, whew, I mean, wow, that's you guys are really hyping this up a lot. Like, I hope there's a full issue of lightsaber assembly, where he's, like, following blueprints, and then he realizes he had the blueprint, you know, flipped the wrong way, and he built it backwards, and hijinks ensue.
It's more like an IKEA thing. We've already kicked into that, like, with issue 2. We started with that process. So right now, it's him trying to find the crystal for his lightsaber, and because of
where's the galactic hot topic, you know, they're like, well, we've got blue and green. He's like, you got anything a little bit more like hardcore?
Well, and something that says
daddy issues.
Yeah. He basically has to find somebody with a lightsaber, kill them and take it, and then corrupt the crystal. So
really,
he's basically like, oh fuck, we just killed all the Jedi, like, now I gotta go fucking find another one, god damn it. I wish somebody had told me about this a month ago. Like,
I was drowning in lightsaber crystals at that point.
That is the funniest thing in the entire world to me. okay, sorry.
But they're doing it well. I mean, it's kind of a silly conceit, but it's extremely well done. So
awesome. Nick, what about you? What are you excited for this week? We're going to put you in the corner with your pick, too.
Yeah, that's fine. My poll is short this week, which is fine because last week was bad. The week before was worse. So my pick is Green Arrow 28. This is part of the Hard Traveling Hero arc, which I think, and I'm sure hardcore Green Arrow fans are going to correct me on this, but I'm pretty certain this is an homage to a much older arc that did the same sort of thing possibly decades ago. Where Ollie, each issue of this arc is Oliver Queen teaming up with a different, possibly superpowered, possibly better known, possibly higher profile DC superhero. Mm-hmm. And this issue is going to be Wonder Woman. The cover looks fantastic. I can't say it enough. I still feel like this is one of the most underrated books of the DC Rebirth. The fact that the art team of Juan Ferreira and Otto Schmidt has remained intact is still very impressive to me. And what I really like about this book is that they've attempted to give it a real grounded feel, give it a real, like, he lives in Seattle. It's not some weird mythical city. It's not some made-up place. They are also attempting to rectify this whole stupid question of, is it Seattle? Is it Star City? What's going on? Which one is it? Because, of course, there are these weird, like, magnetic or whatever ley lines that exist below the city, and they make up a star because pentagrams and shit, right? And that's
sure.
That's the whole issue that's going on in the arc that precedes this hard-traveling hero thing. But it's a fantastic read. It's a fun book. Ben Percy is not getting the credit he deserves. He is penning a fantastic book here. And I honest to God hope that everything sort of remains intact, because I'm enjoying it a lot. And the best kept secret about this book is that it really is a team book. It says it's Green Arrow, but honestly, this is basically a team book between him and Black Canary and Diggle and Emiko, his half-sister. It really is more of a group effort, and I've really enjoyed it for that. So,
gotcha. And so, let me put you in the corner, Nick. Do you prefer Green Arrow with or without the goatee? I just got to ask that question.
You know, it's funny because it's a great question, because normally I'm still a big Jeff Lemire, Andrea Sorrentino run fan. And because of that, I'm actually okay without the goatee, because I believe firmly that the goatee follows the slippery slope down to the Robin Hood hat and the stupid one-liners and the casual slash not so casual harassment of Black Canary. So I believe that the goatee is frequently a step in the wrong direction.
The goatee is a warning sign.
Yeah, but the way Otto Schmidt draws facial hair is so oddly, like, geometric and sort of rough and pointed, to a way that as long as we don't end up with the Robin Hood hat, which is what I consider stage two of the Green Arrow douche meter, as long as we don't hit the Robin Hood hat, like, I think we're okay for now. Don't worry, I'm very carefully monitoring this.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
It's a thankless job.
For me this week, I'm lukewarm about 7 to Eternity number 8. This book that I've been kind of championing for a while, or at least trying to. I really love the opening arc of this story, and now I'm kind of wondering what the fuck is going on, Charles Soule, because story took a heart.
Remender, right?
Sorry, Rick Remender. That's my bad. What the fuck
say,
is going
Charles
on?
Charles Soule is on every other book in the world right now.
Yes. But. Yeah.
Or Matt Kent, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm kind of wondering what's going on with this series. 7 to Eternity is kind of taking a left turn, and I don't really know why, because we were on a pretty good path of solid story with enough surprise that we didn't need to take a left turn. Like, nothing in the story to me was getting stale, and because we were still discovering the world, and then we finally took this left turn in the last, I guess, issue 7, we lost a character, some of the things, we got some origin, we got, like, I don't know, issue 7 just, it felt so strange to me. So I'm really hoping that issue 8 gets us right back on track and we catch up with our main character and the Mud King and some other things that are going on. I don't want to spoil too much, but yeah, kind of big question mark on this issue. So in my notes, I said, how are you going to clean this up, mate? Because that's what I'm genuinely wondering. So Remender, please keep me on this book. Please keep me interested. I really just want to love this book. Like, the art is still top notch, fantastic, beautiful. The more we can get of the Piper, the more my life will be better, because he's a man with a flute that kills you for fun. So come on, like, you've already got me out there with some absurdity. Just keep the story in like a less topsy-turvy fashion, and we should be fine. So that's me. I don't know.
Have you heard the singles of that book are, like, worth a lot of money right now?
Apparently. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, I've got all of them.
Well, there you go. I don't know why. I don't know if there's talk of it being adapted or it was approved to be adapted, but yeah, I was in my comic shop a while ago and the guy who runs it was saying that those issues have gone up a lot in value recently. Well, like, kind of crazy, but
good to know. My number one is signed, so
jeez. Well,
yeah, I think it's actually signed to me, so you know, fuck me, right? But so that whatever. Worth
tens of dollars, Mike.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure to someone else named Mike, it might actually, you know, carry over okay. So
Mike's Only Variant Edition. For our show this week, we are discussing our Goodreads pick of the month. It is Superman Red Sun by Mark Miller, and I'm not going to mispronounce his name, Mark Miller, Dave Johnson, and Killian Plunkett. This is a book published by DC in 2003, question mark? I don't have the year actually written down, but nonetheless, we did read it. It is a three-issue miniseries in an alternate timeline about what if, basically asking the question, what if Superman landed in Soviet Russia rather than Kansas, United States? So, to start the discussion, I guess, we'll just go with a broad question. What did you guys think of this book? Like, going into it, I think it's very obvious what this story is going to be about, but ultimately, what did you think? And full spoilers for Superman Red Sun, just to get that out of the way, because we always forget on the show. So let's start with you, Nick. What were your initial thoughts?
First off, I want to say, I hope there's someone who, like, every week is like, oh, thank goodness, this one is spoiler-free, and then, like, gets, like, 30 minutes in, and they're like, not again, I've been thwarted.
Sorry,
folks. One of these times. No, we're getting better. We really are. Overall thoughts on Red Sun. Going in, you know, I will admit, I judge a book by its cover. Maybe not always literally the cover, but it does happen, subconsciously or not. And yes, Superman was a little bit of a strike one. Mark Miller was a little bit of a strike two. that did not help. For me, Mark Miller is a little bit of a crapshoot. And of course, Superman, don't get me wrong, I'm aware that there are good stories out there. I've read a bunch of them. I've read Grant Morrison's Superman. I've read Jeff Loeb's A Superman for All Seasons. I think that's the one with Tim Sale.
Yeah.
And I really like both of those stories. But of course, there's still always this anxiety of how do you deal with Superman in a way that keeps him from not killing everyone and destroying everything, and then someone inevitably has kryptonite. But right. But in terms of this book overall, yes, placing it in a different scenario, I think this is technically Earth 30 if you go by the New 52 multiverse rules, which of course everyone has their multiverse rule book. I don't need to mention this. Everyone's clearly turned to page 192 like I am, so you know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You're all well versed in DC multiverse.
Yes. No,
you know,
not at
whatnot.
All.
yeah, I mean the detailed but, cosmology is why we all come to these books.
Yeah. Exactly, so. Exactly. Yeah. We're here to discuss that stuff primarily. But I think the way in which Mark Miller couched the idea of saying like it's an interesting what if scenario. What if he ends up in Russia and in the service of the USSR? Does that change him? Conversely, does he change them? And of course, how do those interactions on a larger scale change American history, change global history, the whole butterfly effect, if you will, minus Ashton Kutcher sort of rippling outwards? And I think those sorts of situations are always fascinating. And I think the temptation to not automatically flip the switch, so to speak, on Superman and just be like, well, he was with the good guys before in this story. He's with the bad guys. And how do we find a way of stopping him? For me, that would have been the easy way out of this book. The very easy way out of this
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, he says, what if Superman is holding true to certain internal, you know, incontrovertible values the likes of which he also held when he was sort of quote-unquote, I guess you could say, America's Superman. You know, what if he holds on to those values, and those values are in conflict with the, you know, nationalism and the geographic location in which he's been placed?
Right.
And I think that was the tough route to take, and Mark Miller took it, and I applaud him for that, because that not only makes his job a lot tougher as a writer, but it creates a level of conflict in this book that I think is much more engaging. And so you also end up rooting for Superman, but in a different context than before. And then obviously as the book plays out, you start to end up on this emotional roller coaster of just, who is the bad guy? Who am I supposed to root for? And if anything else, I thoroughly love Dave Johnson as an artist. Much like Alex Ross, here you have an artist who's largely known for cover work, mostly doing covers throughout his career.
Right.
I see him doing Valiant covers. Let me interrupt you really quick.
Let me interrupt
you.
Yeah,
sure. No,
sorry. Because I know we can talk about the art in a second. Just wanted a quick overview.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before,
that's fine.
But I do want to touch on one thing that you mentioned, that two of our regular contributors, I should say, on Goodreads pointed out about the nature of the character of Superman. Alex from the group said, "Do we grow up with the same confidence and swagger of, you know, being a good person, or do we evolve into it in a different way based on how we are raised?" He said, mm-hmm. "That for me is the magic of this book and literature in general." But I mean, in this book, I think the thing that you pointed out stands, that, you know, Superman still intrinsically has this need to do good, which I thought was an interesting point. And another contributor said, Chris was his name, Red Sun asked an interesting question about Superman. Is his benevolent disposition towards humanity the result of nature or nurture? That is he good because he was raised to be good, or will he always be the hero despite his upbringing? Which I think is kind of the umbrella in which this book sits. As you read throughout the three issues, I mean, that seems to be very clear. There is an answer. But before we go into that even further, Brian, what were your overall thoughts of this book?
Overall, I enjoyed it. I think I liked it a lot more when I read it in college.
Okay.
Just because I think I was a lot more obsessed with what-if scenarios back then, instead of, you know, like, instead of asking what if Superman was raised in the USSR, I'm asking, you know, what if I just didn't pay rent this month? much more dangerous questions to be asking yourself.
Sure, sure.
I found myself frequently rolling my eyes during reading this.
Okay.
Anytime that Lex Luthor...
You ought to get that checked out, Brian.
Anytime Lex Luthor was on the page, I just instinctively started making like the jerking off motion with the one hand. Because every scene of Lex Luthor is just him masturbating.
Oh, I mean, God, sure.
Yeah. It was like, I'm reading Machiavelli.
There are thoughts to be shared on this. Yeah.
We can go into that in a moment. Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't know. This is a middle of the road experience for me.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think. I mean, my overall thoughts about this book are pretty much that. Yeah, I think I definitely enjoyed it more when I was in college. There were some large chunks that I just totally forgot about. And so in rereading this book, I mean, I think I read this, must have been 2007, 2008. So quite a while ago. And with that being said, I mean, I remember thinking, like, this is so kick-ass. Look at this poor version of Batman. Look at this change in the Thing, and somehow this happened, and Diana shows up, and Lois Lane is all, you know. I thought there were some cool things that went on. I liked the way that they switched the U.S. presidency, where Nixon became president and was assassinated, and JFK, you know, survived. There were some interesting points, but ultimately, yeah, I was kind of middle of the road. I think when this came out, this book was pretty revolutionary, right? So when we're looking back on books like this, I think it's one thing to keep in mind is that, like, this, a book like this pretty much, I think it kicked a lot of ass, if I'm remembering correctly, because it was such a quote-unquote edgy take on this character. And now we've seen Mark Miller do this 100 times over, so maybe it feels kind of bland in comparison. Like, we're not talking about something like that fucking evil Iron Man book that he did that I can't remember the name of, Nemesis.
Oh God!
You know, we're so pushed to the extreme, or like in comparison, like this is a baby's book. This is doesn't really even push the envelope. So, I mean, but nonetheless, there were some things, like to Brian's point, I think, where it was like, okay, Lex, like get the fuck over yourself. Like, what are you actually trying to accomplish? But that to me was like Luther. Him trying to show off Luther's intelligence in that he is the smartest man in the world. So overall, I didn't hate this book. I don't think I loved it as much as I used to, but I don't think by any means that this is like a bad book, like a bad comic. I think it's still pretty well put together. I know Miller having an editor helps a lot too. But ultimately, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a fun take on Superman. If you haven't read some like any other Elseworlds scenarios and you're really into Superman, it's kind of like a lot of nods and a lot of fun references, like Jimmy Olsen being the badass CIA agent, or at least the vice president. Yeah, vice president eventually. So, yeah, but I guess into the more intricacies of this story. I know, Nick, you were going to go into the art before I, you know, basically told you to shut up for a second. In regards to,
as you should.
Yeah. In regards to Dave Johnson's work, I feel like I've seen his work, but I can't remember from what else. So I think you have some more context on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've seen a lot of his work with Valiant recently. He's done some fantastic Bloodshot Reborn covers. He's done some covers for the latest EXO Man of War series. I just literally picked one up yesterday. He also has done DC work. He was doing a lot of fantastic covers during Palmiotti and Gray's All-Star Western during the New 52.
Okay.
So I'm used to seeing him doing cover work, and usually there's a certain level of anxiety that comes when you have someone who does a lot of cover work that then switches to interiors, because you're like, oh man, first off, is this issue gonna like hit press on time? And then beyond that, I don't want to stereotype, but frequently a lot of these people that tend to largely do covers, they don't always capture the knowledge or have a strong handle on panel work, so to speak. Like, and again, I know, Nick, you've got a target on this guy's back all the time, but Alex Ross and Kingdom Come, to me, feels like a lot of paintings. Just sitting around, they all feel so static, and I think it's a lot of times because these artists and whatnot aren't used to people telling them, like, I need six massively smaller pictures on this page conveying motion instead of one gorgeous, beautiful picture. But I feel like Dave Johnson handles interior pencils and panel work really, really well. I think the character designs for this are fantastic. There was a really hilarious note in my version, which I think was like the new digital version, where Dave Johnson points out that a lot of his co-creator friends gave him shit for the Batman hat, but he liked it. So he's like, oh, yeah. Too bad. The Batman hat is staying.
I love the Batman hat.
That scene where he's wearing that stupid hat and he leans over to a mini fridge in a shitty ass depot and pulls out a couple beers and starts chugging beers. I was like this book gets a bonus 2 points on a scale out of 10 just for that hilarious scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Comrade Batman completely right. One of my favorite parts. This book.
Comrade Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think Brian's completely right. Once, and I should mention this because I'm sure people maybe don't think this, but being quote-unquote the DC guy who's reading this book, this is actually the first time I've read this book. I had never actually read this book before, possibly because of those two strikes I mentioned earlier. And yeah, there are certain things that as time goes on or you read other things, this book doesn't quite end up as shocking or as monumental. I mean, once you've seen Pilgrim Batman and Caveman Batman, Soviet Batman is not quite as shocking.
Right.
But that aside, like, I want to go back to what Brian was saying real quick about Lex Luthor. And what is the deal with, I feel like both Luthor and Superman are like turned up to 11 in this book. Like, powers-wise, Superman is above and beyond anything I've ever seen before. Hearing, his senses are on a scale that I've never seen before. And he takes down Wonder Woman easily. He dismantles the whole Green Lantern Corps. Brainiac. He gets rid of his whole rogues gallery within a matter of seconds, and it's like, I don't really understand, and I wish maybe Mark Miller would have found a way to explain why he's absolutely fucking insane in this book. Luther on the same thing. He's like, by the way, right now I'm playing 80 games of chess, I'm learning Urdu, and I just balanced the U.S. budget with an equation. Here you go. You'll have to plug in the numbers yourself. And I'm like, when was he ever fucking this smart? Are you kidding me?
And that big a dick about it.
Well, I feel like Lex Luthor is constantly a dick about how smart he is and just how much better, or I guess how better he is than people.
Why don't you go build your green power armor you fucking love so much?
Yeah,
why aren't you doing that?
Yeah, yeah.
God.
His green and purple power suit.
Yeah, where's the power suit? So, you were wasting your time. You could be building a power suit.
Yeah. So I'm really curious. So you guys, I'm assuming, read this in digital format, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I have the actual, I have physical copies of this book, physical copies of the individual issues that I picked up at a con a long, long time ago that have been on my shelf forever. Sure. And I've never cracked them open before because I had read this digitally like a long time ago. Or maybe I think I had borrowed someone's.
You had the trade.
I had the trade. That's correct.
Because that was how I read it the first time, was borrowing it from you.
Right. And yeah, I think I gave that trade away when I moved. But so I have the single issue. So reading that, there was no commentary. It was just the book, which was really interesting to see, like hearing your mentioning, Nick, of Dave Johnson's notes on this book. I think it'd be it's really interesting to hear from authors in that regard, from a book like this that has gotten so much or had so much notoriety, like to the point where they've made, you know, there are rumors that they might make a Red Sun movie. There's, you know, so many, like Henry Cavill apparently took the role of Superman because he loved this book as well as a couple of other Superman stories. And there's been a bunch
it's
of merchandising.
Very popular. Yeah, the Injustice games, they have character skins that are Red Sun themed.
Right.
You know, and I mean, yeah, the character designs are great. I love it.
Yeah.
I think it looks fantastic.
So like, I guess reading that, did you guys get a different experience? I know this time around, Brian, you said you read it digitally versus when you read it in trade. What did you think? Was there like a stark difference, or that's always my question when we're reading, you know, digital versus physical copies of books sometimes.
The big issue that I ran into was just using, I was reading it on my computer cause I don't have a tablet or anything like that. I just have like an iPhone 4E or whatever, like old shitty mm-hmm. iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to use guided view because otherwise it was too small and I had to like lean forward over my desk to read it.
Right.
And the guided view of the Hoopla digital
distorted
thing, it's not great.
Right.
You got to use stretch to fit, Brian. That's a Comixology fast tip for all of you casual Comixology users out there.
Well, if it was on Comixology, that would have been different. But it was on Hoopla, which is like
I've heard things about their guided view.
Which, yeah, like, it gets the job done, but, you know, and sure. I'm not trying to blow smoke or anything, but after using Comixology's guided view,
everything else is trash.
Yeah, I mean, straight up.
And we already know how I feel about libraries, so
you can't go back into them.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's right. That's interesting. So, okay, yeah. So I guess reading it in the guided view, was it just like super grainy or something, or like I don't know? I don't know if that's an issue with Hoopla. I've never actually used Hoopla before.
They cut off the panels weird sometimes, so you get like a part of one panel in with another one.
Gotcha.
Ugh, gross.
It's not great, and some books are better than other ones, but it's at the top of the screen. It's like top center justified instead of just being in the center of the page.
Oh, okay.
It's like, that's not a big deal, but it is something that like an anal retentive book dork like myself tends to get mad about. Like,
right.
It's poor layout, and you know I married somebody who lays books out for a living, so.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Nick, I guess was the guided. I don't know if you read it in guided view, if you read it in your pro tip fit to width version or something like that. I know you have like an ancient computer from 1962. So how did you read that? How did you read the book?
Look, after it took 18 hours to boot up, and then I continually wound the crank to to keep the generators running. I prefer for the most part to read in stretch to fit, because I find guided view frequently distorts, and especially with older works or works that maybe weren't originally intended for digital or were adapted to digital, or maybe the scans aren't quite high def. And don't quote me on this, because I don't remember whether or not Red Sun's file on Comixology is technically labeled as high def or not, but definitely there, it felt like there was more distortion than normal. And so I just went stretch to fit, which honestly, a lot of people out there, if you're having problems with your Comixology experience, reading experience, go stretch to fit. It looks great. I don't have any issues with it. So,
gotcha. Cool. Well, so I mean,
there you go. There's my plug.
Sorry. I mean, really weird tangent about that. I'm always curious about that stuff, because I think we all read it on a different format. So it's kind of interesting to hear the different experiences. But outside of that, we're okay. So we've kind of been like poo-pooing a little bit on this book. Were there other things like in the book that were like really good? Do you think were delivered or executed well?
Well, like I said, Mark Miller clearly had a couple narrative moments when creating and designing this book where he could have had some very easy outs, and some easy outs that I think nonetheless would have still been very crowd pleasing to a lot of readers. He could have phoned this in a lot of ways, and the sad truth is there still would have been a lot of people who would have been like, but he's still Russian, that's so edgy, like that alone is edgy enough,
yeah.
And this is, you know, it's Watchmen part two. And so
yeah.
That being said, I think there was a level of nuance that maybe doesn't feel as nuanced now as it did, as it would have been if I, and this is me now speculating about theoretically reading books 10 years before I ever read them. I think if I had read this 10 years ago, I would have been like, oh, well, you know, that's like, let's write a whole 15-page literary criticism essay on this. And now I'm like, well, it's more nuanced than I thought. I do like a lot of the speculative timeline stuff that you guys have been talking about with Nixon becoming president before JFK. And was JFK's wife supposed to be Marilyn Monroe now?
I think that was how I was supposed to be reading between the lines on that.
They mentioned that he's the first president to divorce and remarry in office.
Yeah.
And they show what appears to be his wife, and they don't spell it out, but I'm pretty certain that's supposed to be Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, they say Norma Jean. Yeah, they say Norma Jean, which is Marilyn Monroe's original name.
Real name.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. So I do feel like there's some fun stuff that if you're a fan of American history, if you're a fan of world history, Mark Miller slips it by and thankfully does not wink and nod at you and say, you know, did you get it? Because Norma Jean is Marilyn Monroe, and that is interesting because it is speculated that he had an affair with her, and she's saying, happy birthday, Mr. President, and here's the Wikipedia link. No. Mark Miller just says, oh, it's Norma Jean, and I think that that's fun.
Yeah.
I think that that's fun because there's little things like that, and if you get it, you get it, and there's a little bit more enjoyment, and it makes you feel like Mark Miller took the time to really delve into that era of history, and I do like that aspect of it a good amount, and I do also like the idea that it plays with the whole issue of, you know, Superman can't save everyone, right? But and that's sort of the real, maybe the real moral dilemma of Superman narratives in the past. But now it asks, what if Superman was in a position where he probably could? And what happens when Superman basically becomes the world's worst micromanager because of that?
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me.
Yeah. Before, I want to talk about the end of this book really quick, but to touch on your bit about history, I thought Jason from the group had a quote that I thought was kind of funny. He said, it's a fun read, talking about the book, but Stalin's embrace of the Kryptonian child didn't ring true to true Soviet history. Which, like, is kind of funny. I don't know enough about Soviet history to know if Stalin would adopt a super child or not. But
but the book even does get at the idea that as Stalin's, you know, secret police guy says, you know, to Superman, I don't understand why he embraces you, because you are the antithesis of our beliefs, which is that every man is equal, and here you are displaying, you know, characteristics that are clearly not of this world.
Right.
And I love that he's born in Ukraine, so even then you have this idea of, like, yeah, you're part of us, but you're also not really part of us. So...
Yeah, I think that was, I forget that Ukraine wasn't originally part of Russia. Like, I don't know enough about the world. Like, I think I've said this before on the show, I'm uncultured, I don't really know a lot. So, I will totally own up to that.
Yeah, I think the only reason it worked is that by the time Stalin, like, found out about him, he'd already become superpowered. And so he was useful, and that's why Stalin embraced him.
Yeah.
Because he just grew up on, like, you know, a shitty little dirt farm
commune
in Ukraine up until that point.
Yeah.
So here's another thing we need to talk about. Can we talk about the superfluous cameos in this book? If there is one thing I have an issue with, it's the cameos that are for cameo's sake and are stupid.
Like what?
Okay, so the Jimmy Olsen one is fine. Obviously, he's more than a cameo, but I love that instead of shitting on him or killing him like the new DC movies did.
Yeah.
Good God, was that a shocker? They go ahead and they fucking make him vice president. But like Oliver Queen is like working for the Daily Planet. Did I not understand that right? Or is that what was going on? Yeah. Because that was weird and that did not ring true at all.
They did mention Barry Allen as well, as like he was out on some murder thing, so he couldn't show up to some party.
His wife was working for the Daily Planet, right. Iris West. Yep. Yeah. So that one I was kind of like, okay. The Hal Jordan was fine. I was okay with that. The fact that they
Guy Gardner showed up.
No,
for
not
like,
Guy.
Or who was
Kyle? Kyle Rayner showed up, and they couldn't resist making fun of him for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting as well. I'm trying to think of what other ones I
there
was
like.
There
was
okay.
his childhood crush.
Yeah, Lana Lang.
Yeah. It's not Lana Lang anymore, though.
And they did such a real shitty job attempting to make it clear with her name that it's like Lana Langs, and then there's like an S or a Z on the end or something where it's like, see, she's Russian now.
Yeah.
This is like an awkward like page stuffed in the middle of like him finding her in a bread line and then giving her a job at the Superman Museum.
Yeah, like...
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. I thought the implementation of Wonder Woman was interesting. I love that Stalin is this fucking idiot who, like, Hippolyte is like, well, you know, we're thinking about allying with you. You guys seem to have some good policies in regards to women's rights. Maybe you don't have the best in terms of human rights on the whole. And then he's like, well, why don't we go discuss this in my bedroom? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We're going to have sex. And she's like, and that's why we're a little bit hesitant to really hang out with you that much, okay? And I'm like, good God, world leader, keep it in your fucking pants.
Sorry, were there more cameos that you wanted to discuss? Because we really should try to wrap this up. I do want to talk about the end of
this. Don't worry,
book.
Those are all the ones I can come up with, but I felt like that was another itty bitty little thing that Mark Miller could have been like, you know what, the gang does not need to be all here.
Sure.
Like, okay.
Sure.
It's
not to mention
Wonder Woman.
There was no mention of any other world power, but like, I think that didn't matter. Like, it ultimately came down to they were trying to tell a Superman story, and part of Superman's life is this Justice League group, but let's figure out where they ended up being, like, where they ended up because they were no longer part of this Justice League. But so with the end of this book, again, you know, we're already into this, but full spoilers for the end of this book, you know, it turns out that there's this whole time travel thing, and that when Superman disappears from the world, humanity prospers. But the question I think remains, could humanity have prospered had it not been for Superman, or was Lex Luthor going to, you know, still become the great Lex Luthor that he became? You know, I think that was an interesting question to pose about this, because Lex Luthor only started to work so hard simply because he was trying to outwit and destroy Superman for no other reason other than he was like, there can be no one better than me.
That like motherfucker for his own beat selfish me at reason. Chess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Bizarro beat him at chess. Like, fucking... What a ridiculous moment. Like, Bizarro shows up, and then he's immediately killed. But, like, Lex's whole thing is, fuck my whole life. I need to kill Superman because his clone beat me at chess. Like, what a ridiculous moment in the story. But the end of this book, like, what did you guys think of the whole, like, infinite loop of it?
Go ahead, Brian. Sorry.
I,
go ahead.
I didn't see it coming, so in that sense it was effective as like a twist ending. But it's also one of those twist endings where like you look at it for a minute and then you go, oh wait, no, I didn't see it coming, because it doesn't make any sense. Like, because they don't establish anything about like why the yellow sun would give a human their powers or anything like that. Like, nothing is established for why he has powers, except for like they mention a pill that means you don't have to sleep anymore. And like,
this family is very good at science.
So of course, when they send their son back in time,
given infinite numbers of family members and in infinite years of time, they will eventually. Yeah, exactly. This book is like the ultimate of like fast forwards at the end. They're like, by the way,
57 generations down,
all of this happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end, I was like, oh, okay. Wait, Wikipedia, help me, please.
Yeah.
And then Wikipedia is like, this is called a predestination paradox. And I'm like, at least I have a fucking name for it now. And they're like, I was like, let's make sure I understood this right. So now the end of the book sets up the beginning of the book.
Yeah,
and it's and I'm like, why?
See, what I thought.
Why do you need that?
What I thought could have been a better twist ending is the whole, you know, we have to send him back in time to save humanity or something like that. But at the same time, I would have preferred if the end would have been Superman landing in the United
States. Landing in America?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what came to mind for me,
that's
too.
What I was
like,
was
I know where this book is going, and I'm happy with that ending.
Yeah. So the fact that he ends up in the Ukraine at the end, I mean, I guess works in this whole predestination paradox, like Nick mentioned. But, it still felt a little, like, ham-fisted. In a couple of ways, like, sure, it all kind of makes sense, like, but Earth is still Earth, like, and these people have history, and if they're so smart, like, you'd think that they'd at least be able to track their history a little bit.
Michael, let me set the scene for you. Okay.
Okay,
final panel, Kansas, old pickup truck running down a dust road, just throwing up a huge dust cloud behind it, and off in the distance in the middle of a cornfield you see a little meteorite explosion. Final panel of the book. Perfect.
I got you. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, regardless, you know, of that, like, this book, it kind of, I think I described it to Nick when he first started reading it. I was like, it's got a little bit of a gotcha ending. And I think at the time, this was a pretty solid way to end the book. In the sense that, like, the world is cyclical in that regard, so if it's a contained universe and it's not supposed to be connected to the regular DCU, then that's fine. And I think that makes the story work. And in 2003, it was very contained, and it wasn't trying to say, like, oh, this caused the next universe. No. It is itself, and that's fine. I mean, again, seeing this nowadays, we've seen 100,000, you know, time travel bullshit endings at this point. We've all seen Doctor Who. So, you know, at the end of the day, like, it seems a little overdone, and it kind of feels blah, but I do want to just bring back that idea of, in 2003, this may have been pretty cool. So let's not take it, like, completely out of context there. I don't know if you guys... Final thoughts on the book? Because we'll just wrap up here.
Sure.
Yeah. Brian? Final thought. It's a good book that I don't think is standing the test of time.
Yeah. I think what both of you said is very valid. I think it's a book that we've been spoiled in a lot of ways, because for all of the talk about how much comics are getting worse or comics are getting bad, I feel like we've definitely made some progress in certain mature themes and explorations of different ideas. And so we've been spoiled by other people that have possibly been inspired by this book and taken on similar ideas and similar theories. And so, of course, the key bit of information in my mind to be gleaned from that, of course, is that you have to, you know, give respect where respect is due and say, well, maybe this paved the road in certain ways, and not be like a lot of other people these days that are like, you know what, I've seen it before, and not go, well, why have you seen this before?
Right.
There's a reason for that, okay? It's because they saw this. So
Cool. Yeah, I think
I'd say read it. I would say it's on, at least on an artistic level, if you have an appreciation of good art, it's good. If you have an appreciation of speculative history, I think it's got value.
Yeah. My final takeaway from this book is, yeah, kind of similar to Nick's and Brian's. I mean, I think ultimately we're saying this is a book you should read. It may not be the best book you'll ever read, but in terms of comic history in the last 20 years, this is a pretty solid story that you could pick up and as like an alternate to your regular, you know, monthly comic books. I think Mark Miller, despite how often we shit on him on this show, he is capable of writing a good story, and I think we always add that caveat when we're talking about him. And I think this is proof. This is one of those books that he can tell a very solid, deliverable, or complete story in a miniseries without leading you on for anything else. So ultimately, yeah, read this book. It's a pretty solid read. So it's the end of the show. We're doing our new credits thing. 4 weeks off, so I'm pretty rusty at this. But we will start with talking about, you should follow us all on Twitter. You can follow Brian at Brian Head, not the mountain. You're not technically a ski resort, right?
No, there is a Brian Head Ski Lodge. That's not me.
Okay, good. So Brian Head on Twitter. You can follow Nick and his super private account, if he lets you, at Death Star Plans.
DETHPLNZ. Star is spelled like it should be.
Death Star Plans. Yeah, it's a whole crazy thing. Find it in the show notes. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Rappin. You can follow the show at IRCB Podcast. We retweet a bunch of random stuff at all hours of the night. I find myself 3 in the morning, I'm like, cool thing, let's retweet it. We also have weekly polls every Friday. This week's, I think, was which is the best weird team up. And I just put some random shit together. It's really fun. I have a lot of fun in the middle of the day just making those polls up off the top of my head. So go follow us there. You can also, and Nick, this is your thing. I'll let you say this.
Yeah, sure. It's also worth mentioning that we have a Goodreads group, the I Read Comic Books Goodreads group. There are a lot of weekly threads that you can participate in about what you've been up to, what you're reading, what you think about the current book of the month, what are your thoughts on comic books in broader mediums like TV and movies. There's something there for everyone, and there's someone there who will probably disagree with your opinion and vehemently. I'm kidding. Everyone on the Goodreads group is for the most part very well behaved.
I did join, nice.
So maybe it's not as true anymore.
Yeah. Now that Nick is actually on the group, it's actually very hostile. No, but really, to
I was just saying that everybody on there is like uncannily nice. Like,
yeah,
like suspiciously nice.
It's a really pleasant comic book forum, so go join that.
If you like being responded to in articulate thoughts and full sentences, that might be a place you want to go.
You can also visit us at our sexy, sexy website, ircb.us.
Or actually, what it should be is ircbpodcast.com. I just forgot to change up the notes, sorry.
Oh, ircbpodcast.com. Mike is a liar. .gov.
Does the old site redirect to the new site, Michael?
It does. It does redirect.
Perfect. Perfect. Right.
So I'm not wrong, exactly.
You're not wrong, no.
Just an asshole. You can also please rate, subscribe, tell your friends. Those iTunes reviews, I know, like, it doesn't seem like it matters, but it really does help our show find a wider audience. And then you'll have more people to talk about the show with, which is always nice, you know? You know, you're also free to just give us a shout out on Twitter. Just throw a CC to us with the at IRCB podcast Twitter account, and we'll probably like your tweet, which may give you a little rush. It always does me.
I see a mention and I just immediately go, oh, that was nice, and then I'll usually respond with something ridiculous.
On the flip side, if you've wisely sworn off social media because of the, you know, increasing surveillance state that is becoming America, you can email the show at ircb@destroythesybe.org. Michael does actually respond to emails. We are, you know, it's 1998 all over again.
Yeah.
If you have a Hotmail address, Mike will definitely respond to you.
Yes.
If you have a Yahoo, no way in hell.
Nick is totally right about all of that, except for where he's wrong. I will respond to any email for the most part.
even if it's just to ask, why are you still using Hotmail?
Yeah, well, I have gotten an email from someone at AOL, and I was just impressed that that's still a thing. So to round out the show, Infinity Shred does the music for the show. They're the absolute freaking best band in the world. I love them to death. You should go check out their music on Bandcamp or at their website, infinityshred.com. Xander is a wizard. He also edits the show. He was in Switzerland, and you know, he took some really cool pictures, and now I'm really jealous that he got to go to Switzerland. I don't know why I'm telling you that. I just thought I'd let you know. And I do want...
We're just bearing our
souls. Speaking of surveillance state.
So
follow us on Twitter at Where Is Xander.
Yeah. I do want to say thank you for listening to the show. Thank you so much for all of your time and effort. If you took the survey, thank you for taking the survey. I'm sorry this episode is so long. We just had so much to say. We've had 4 weeks off. It's a lot of pent-up, salty frustration. So thank you for joining us, and we will catch you next week. Have you guys seen this Marvel Legacy bullshit where Ghost Rider's on a fucking mammoth, yo? Ghost Rider's on a flaming mammoth. It's a mammoth.
Is that like the with the Bruce Banner Totally Awesome Hulk crossover type thing?
I have no idea. I can't stop talking in this voice though. here,
very interesting second half.
Yeah.
Marvel Legacy.
There's a link. I put it in the IRCB chat link. That's just.
Who are the Avengers of 1 million BC? Jesus fucking Christ. God damn.
I saw a cover of the whole thing. I don't remember where, but I was just like, what the fuck? And someone reminded me that the Ghost Rider one exists, and it's him on a fucking flaming mammoth. So,
I'm here for it,
welcome
though.
Welcome to comic books.
Like, I'll this read is that.
Like, fuck.
Who did that art? Mike...
I have no idea.
Deodato?
Deodato.
I don't know. Is that his name? I think I've heard of him before.
Here we go. Yeah, Mike Deodato Jr. and Matt Wilson. Yeah, here's the full picture. I'll send you guys that.
Well, you know, I've always said, like, Ghost Rider takes himself too seriously and is frequently taken so seriously by other people that... He's just a character that lends himself to let's just do something nuts. So, I thought the whole idea of, oh, this is Legacy. Isn't there another thing they're doing called Legends, right? Isn't that something else then?
Maybe.
What's the one where everyone's getting pissed off because they're like, what if in the future both Thors still exist and both Wolverines still exist, and then all of the people that were like, we want old Wolverine were furious, and then the people that were like, we want you to keep new Wolverine, and this compromise, you know, basically tells everyone that you really weren't happy with new Wolverine anyway, and so we're pissed off too. And so they were just getting it from both ends. Is that this? I don't think this is.
No, that's what I thought he was talking about, but that's a different thing, I guess.
Yeah, that's a different thing where, like, I don't know what the fuck is going on anymore.
Well, like they're just trying to please everyone. Like, literally, it is that it should just be called Marvel. We're trying to make all of you happy. We didn't actually realize that was actually impossible. Whereas DC's like, we hate some of you. No, we really do. And that's making us money.
Yeah, see, it's just like, I understand the gripe that's like, older comics fans or longtime comics fans have superhero books now. We are that generation now. That's the saddest thing in the entire world. I used to get like excited about superhero books, but now it's just like, how have they fucked this up yet again?
Also, anatomically modern humans didn't exist 100 million years ago. So
yeah,
these should all be like Homo erectus or something.
Yeah, I saw this the second image that I sent you was I got from Reddit. Someone was like, "Yeah, a bunch of this is bullshit. Humans didn't look like this, period." So, anyways,
just be chimps in Avengers costumes.
They did that. It was called Marvel Apes.
Shut up.
I'm not fucking joking with you, Brian. Marvel Apes.
No, look, I know Google. You're not kidding. I just wish I didn't know that.
You honestly, know, why don't they do something again like Marvel, what was it, 1492?
Yeah.
And just at least taken a few extra centuries or a few, you know, 1,000 years beyond this and do another interesting sort of thing like that. Why not?
Yeah. You know who read all of Marvel Apes? I just want to read all of that and owned all of it. Fucking I did. I owned all of that bullshit, you guys, at one point.
In singles?
In singles.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a blow to your credibility.
Yeah, I know. It was all really bad, but at that point I had gotten into it so deep, I was like, I have to finish this.
Sander, make sure this stays in.